obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hi, everybody. My name is Lydia.
Lydia
V. from Menifee. But I used to be from Orange County, and there's nothing that rhymes with my name in Orange County, so. I am so excited to be here. Totally excited. I'm wearing two watches. One is to keep time, so I don't go over. And the other one is God's time, which I don't have to look at. It's just good looking. Thank you, Fernando. He's so controlling, but he's good at what he does, so. I didn't know what serenity was. When I was growing up, it was with a mother that was a daily drinker. My mother drank every day. And I loved my mother, and I hated my mother at the same time. She was a lot of fun. Everybody loved her. Everybody wanted her at the party. And I was ashamed of her. I was ashamed to have people come over the house, my friends. I didn't have that many friends. We moved a lot. My father was in the service. We moved so many times. I went to a lot of different schools. The only time I actually stayed in one school is in high school, except for 3 months. My father was stationed in Hawaii, and he sent for us. It was my mother, my younger sister, and myself. And by that time, I was in high school. I was in my senior year. I had a boyfriend, and I wanted to graduate with my class. Finally, I had friends, and I wanted to just be there with them. And so they didn't have the money to send me home, you know, on the Navy paycheck. But my father was a gambler. He was a card player, and he played pool. He was all of those fun things. And he drank a lot, too. He was a bartender. He drank a lot, but his drinking didn't bother me. Of course, he was away a lot. So my father had some poker games, and he wanted enough money to send me home. And he sent me home to my grandmother, my mother's mother, who I adored. And you know that she loved me unconditionally. She was my savior. All through the years, when we moved to some place, and I always used to ask, why are we moving again? Well, I never got the answer. But we would move either back to my grandmother's or someplace else. Back to my grandmother's or someplace else. When we lived with my grandmother, it wasn't bad because she was home when I got home from school with my little sister. And when we didn't live with her, we got home and there was nobody there. We were latchkey kids. We had the string with the key under my little shirt, and that was shame-filled for me. Plus, I was afraid. I was afraid all the time. So I was fear-based, shame-based, and all of that. There's a good reason, I think, why that happened, why I got these feelings that, you know, I didn't know the word abandonment back then, but that's what I felt like. When I was 4 years old, I think my mother and father were separated at the time. I'm not sure, but he wasn't around, and he hadn't joined the Navy yet. And so, everybody was moving out of this one area, and my mother and my little sister were going to move with my aunt. They were going to build some housing projects there. So all of these people had to move. All of these homeowners had to move. And we were living with my aunt at that time. And so my mother and my little sister went with my aunt. And my mother sent me with a family from next door that were going to move to West LA in the Adams section. And so there I was, very nice family, a very nice family. The lady was Mrs. Pitts. She just took care of me and all that. And I was crying constantly for my mother. I was gone for 1 year till I was five. And when I came back, it was as if nothing had happened. Nobody said anything. The time that I was gone for that whole year, I believe I saw my mother twice. And so that did something to me. It did something. So that later on, what happened was that if I would go to the movies with friends or something, or even when I started school at around age six, and so I would wonder, are they going to be there when I get home? Mm. And so it did a number on me. It messed me up. Besides the drinking, besides it. But I come from a family where everybody drank. The uncles, my other grandmother, cousin, everybody drank. And when they had parties, which they had a lot of parties, it was for everything. I mean, they had parties for baptisms, for weddings, for funerals. There was always a party. For a little kid, they'd have a party for a little kid. It would turn into a grown-up party because it was always going to be liquor. There was always going to be booze. My family didn't trust anybody that did not drink. And so, you know, there was Uncle Charlie. Oh, God, is Charlie coming? Please, you know, they couldn't stand him because he didn't drink. And so that's basically how it was. Later on, during the times that we weren't living with my grandmother, my mother, who I believe was a great actress, would go to the neighborhood church, and she did this twice that I know of, and talk to the priest and tell the priest that she had this little girl that really needed a lot of work. She just couldn't handle her. So she wanted to send me to a convent. And they're expensive, room and board at a convent. So, but she would present her case. She could have been a lawyer and an actress, now that I think about it. So she would have them arrange for a charity case, me, to go and interview for the convent. This happened at the Villa Cabrini Academy for Girls in Burbank. It was the scariest thing in the world. It was so scary to go there. It was just a little girl. Mm-hmm. And part of that process was to go to the clinic in Los Angeles and get checked, which was very scary too. And I got to thinking, my mother doesn't protect me from anything, not even from pain. And almost at the moment that I was gonna be sent to the Villa Cabrini Academy for Girls, my little grandmother, my mother's mother, would show up, you know, like the Lone Ranger. She'd show up and she says, "You're not doing this." "No, no, no," she spoke Spanish. "No, no, no, no me la lleves, no te la vas a llevar." And so my mother would, you know, bide her time. Then she did it again, maybe a year or two later. Different church, we had moved again, different priest, and this time it was a Ramona school for girls. And so same process, same thing, and my grandmother shows up, and I didn't go. And my mother, she just didn't want me around. I wanted her to love me. I wanted to hug her and do that, love. She couldn't do it. And I took it very personally. That's one of my big, big character defects. I take things personally. Not so much now, because of Al-Anon, because of program, and because all the things that we learn as the process of the program goes on. Like I said, I loved her and I hated her at the same time. So time passes, and I'm taking care of my little sister when we're not living with my grandmother. And it's scary. She gets dressed up sometimes, like on a Friday after work. She always worked. And my father's not there. And she's all dressed up with her little high heels and ready to go dancing, love to go dancing. And I would say, are you going to go dancing? Oh, no, no. And I would try and stay awake, because it was just my sister and I in the house, or in the duplex, or in whatever, wherever we lived. And she, finally, I would have to go to sleep. I mean, finally, a little girl goes to sleep. Then I'd wake up maybe midnight, and she was gone. And it was just my sister and I. Then I would hear the squeaky floors. I would imagine somebody turning the doorknob. I would imagine somebody's coming in the window. All those things. I lived a lot in my head, you know. I have a very busy head, and I lived a lot in here. So then the next day, I would scold her. So by the age of 9, I'm her mother. I felt like my mother's mother. I would scold her. So high school was fantastic. I loved it. Lived with my grandmother, graduated, and had my boyfriend. And right when after we graduated from school, I wanted to get married. Back then, some of my friends were getting married, and they were getting their little apartment, and they had their baby, and eventually, you know. And I wanted to marry my boyfriend. And he said, I think it was normal, because he said no. He said no. He wanted to get an education. He wanted to go to college. And I took that very personally. So what did I do? Well, we used to go cruising down Whittier Boulevard. And one of the things that we did, one of the girlfriends would borrow her mother's car. And I cut off my nose to spite my face. My boyfriend didn't want to marry me, so I'm going to start going out and meeting other boys, going out with other boys. So we cruise. I forgot to tell you, I'm from Boyle Heights area of LA. And that's where Whittier Boulevard, we used to go cruising on Whittier Boulevard. And off of Soto Street and Whittier Boulevard, there's a Frosty Freeze. And behind Frosty's were all the cool guys. All the cool guys were behind Frosty's. So we'd cruise, and then we ended up behind Frosty's. And there were these milk crates where these guys sat and played bongos and played guitars. And a little way off from the pack was this one guy. And this one guy, he didn't play an instrument or anything. He just sat there. He was so cool. And he wore the pants with a crease that was so creased that you could shave your legs with them. And the suede jacket. He was cool. But, and his name was Big Mondo. He wasn't that big. But he was bigger than little Mondo. So, yeah, I took a shine to him because nobody messed with him. And, oh, I thought, this is it. This is it. So, but you know what I found out? Just because a guy is real quiet doesn't mean he's deep. I made a lot of mistakes, a lot of relationship mistakes, and that was probably the biggest one. 6 months later, we were married. A little over a year later, I had my first baby, little baby girl. And about a year after that, I had a baby boy. 6 years pass, and I have another baby boy. And we were so young when we got married. We were just so young, and I was so dumb. I didn't know how to be a mom. I didn't know how to be a wife. I just shot from the hip, you know, said whatever I wanted to say, and that didn't go over real well as time went on. Because we used to have parties, and we'd go to parties. We were a young couple, and we'd go and play cards, and people were starting their families, so we all had little kids and everything. And so there was a lot of drinking that went on at the card parties, and most of us could stop. But as time went on, my then husband, it got bad. There was jealousy on both sides. There was jealousy, possessiveness, and then violence came into our home. Violence, physical violence, and this was my weapon of choice. I could say things to him that would just rip him up. And it's like that toothpaste tube comes out, you can't put it back in. And so I would just say things that were so unkind, and that was my way of getting back at him. But there was a lot of stuff that went on there. My kids saw it. And I, you know, we worked, he always worked, and one day, he got home from work an hour before I did. And when I got home from work, and I better get home at the same time every day, I worked in Los Angeles downtown, and we lived in Whittier then. And I never knew how it was going to be when I came home. I never knew how the mood was going to be, because see, his mood was my mood. Mm-hmm. If everything was okay with him, everything was Jake with me. So I would turn the corner to where we lived, six houses down, and I'd get that knot in my stomach. And when I get to the house, finally walk in, I'd have to change clothes, wash up, and start dinner. And I never knew if the kids were going to be sitting there like little, you know, zombies, or what was going to happen with, you know, were they crying? Were they okay? I never knew. So, except one day. What I have to tell you, too, is that I've always had a God in my life, but I didn't know it. I didn't know it until I came into Al-Anon and started looking and seeking and working the steps and talking to people, listening to people who had miracles in their life. And then I had to remember all the times that something bad could have happened to me and didn't. I could have been hurt seriously. He threw a couch at me one day. And he wasn't big, but he was strong. Anyway, I digress. So what happened was that I came home this one day, and you know that I didn't have a knot in my stomach when I turned the corner? you go to my house? I went into the house and I said, I walked right up to him in a very calm voice and I said, I can't live like this anymore. And he said, huh? He was reading the paper or something. I don't even know if the kids were there. And he said, huh? I said, I can't live like this anymore. You have to go. And he said, when? And I said, next Tuesday. And he said, okay. See, God didn't let me know that he had somebody outside. He had somebody. And so he left. And now the problem's gone. I'm there with my three kids. You know, the baby, he's a couple of years old. No, he was older than that. He was older than that. You know, I stayed in that marriage for 19 years. That's the denial, and that's the no self-worth, low self-worth that I had. And I marvel at the God of my understanding that was always there. I didn't flip the switch to turn on that light. It was always there. So then he said okay and he left. But I was still there in the house. And I'm a sick, sick person. Very sick at this time. And I noticed that my middle child, he was drinking. See, my radar had always been on the husband. And I didn't notice that my son had, he told me later he'd been drinking since he was 12. And so I just, it hurt me so bad to see my son when I saw him drunk at one time. And he went, once we got separated and then got a divorce, it just went downhill real fast in my house. And he wasn't even there anymore. I have to tell you, too, that desperate people do desperate things. And before I had gotten the courage to change, I had seen this article in a magazine that if you have pets or little children, you shouldn't have this plant in your yard. And we had the plant in our yard. This was a poisonous plant. And so I was so desperate that I took the leaves of that plant. And my husband loved salads. And so I took the leaves of that plant and I washed them real good. And I just made the most beautiful salad for him. And I gave him this, it was great. It was beautiful. So I gave him the salad and then I went to the sink and I'm waiting for him to die. Washing the same glass over and over. Finally, I look, he says, it's so good. He said, it's so good. He said, you want to wash the bowl? I said, yeah. He didn't die. But he had diarrhea for 3 days. If it had happened the other way, somebody would be taking a panel into the prison for me. Thank you. So we sort of scattered, my youngest son, at that point. I signed for him to go into the service. He was my beautiful son that I thought this thing had not touched him. This thing called alcoholism had not touched him. That's what I thought. But it's a family disease. It touches, in my opinion, everybody. We had a dog that was crazy. It touched everybody. And then I got I got a little place in Uptown Whittier, my own little place. By this time, my daughter had had a baby out of wedlock. She was pregnant and then had the baby out of wedlock. Like I said, my youngest had gone into the service, and my middle son. It took him. The disease of alcoholism took him to places that I never wanted to see anybody's child go there. He ended up in Skid Row in Los Angeles. Young man, good-looking guy, sweet, smart. He was the smartest of my three children. Well-read, funny, but he was a drunk. And when he drank, his personality changed, and nobody wanted to be around him. Nobody wanted to have him around. And so he was in Skid Row, and I was so desperate to do something. See, I always had to do something about something. I couldn't let it go. I learned to let go in this program. You know, not just let go, but the second part of that is let God. So I didn't know how to do that. I'm so grateful to this program for all the lessons. Out of the seemingly bad, there's always something good, in my opinion. And so I called a relative of mine. I knew she was in AA, but I didn't know what AA was. I knew it was a place where somebody wanted to go if they didn't want to drink anymore. And so I called her up. Now, she's my son's cousin. So I figured, you know, she can help me. She can tell me what to do. So I'm telling her the sad story about my son and Skid Row. She already knew all this. And so she let me talk for a little while, and then she stopped me. She said, "It sounds like you need Al-Anon." I said, "What is that? I'd never heard that before." She said, "It's in the phone book. Look it up." And she hung up on me. That's what an alcoholic, that's the difference between an alcoholic and somebody like me that's in Al-Anon. She hung up on me. But I looked it up. I did. And it was a Wednesday, and I went to that meeting Wednesday night. Now, if somebody had called me and asked me about, you know, and I would suggest maybe going to Al-Anon, and they said okay, I would have given them the number. I would have looked it up myself. Hey, there's a meeting tonight. How about I pick you up? Take them to the meeting, sit next to them, and point out somebody that would be a perfect sponsor. Okay. But that's the difference. That's a big difference. So I went that night to the meeting in Whittier, and it was nice. It was nice, but I didn't get anything out of it. See, from where I come from, which is from nothing, I still feel entitled. It's crazy. It's the disease, I think. I still feel entitled. Don't they know who I am? Yeah, you're a girl from Boyle Heights that had a drunk mother. That's who you are. Well, that's who I am. But see, I wanted to play the part even in an Al-Anon meeting. Even in an Al-Anon meeting. So it was nice, and I think I got my first resentment at that meeting because they did not have a newcomer packet. They said they were going to give me a newcomer packet, and then they said, "Oh, you know what? We're out of them." I took it personally. One more time. They knew I was coming, and that's why they don't have one. Sick, sick, sick girl. So we used to go, you know, as time went on, not that much time, but as time went on, after I got my divorce, there were like three or four friends, girlfriends, that we loved to go dancing, just like my mother. And so we would meet at this nightclub. We loved the band, and we would meet there. And it was so fun. And we did it every week. And we dance, and we have a good time, and then that was it. Now, this one time, I was sitting with my back to the entrance, and one of the gals that was sitting facing the entrance said, "Oh my God, did you see who just what just walked in?" And I was too cool for the room, so I didn't want to turn. And so, as luck would have it, or the opposite of luck would have it, this guy came to our table, and a mutual friend from the club introduced him, and that was Nikki. So he came over, and he was good looking. He was tall. He was fine. He was so fine. Had a drink in his hand, and he put the drink down and he asked me to dance. Not only did he know how to dance, he smelled good. He knew how to dance. He knew all the, he was just great. Oh my God. And so that was the beginning of that relationship. Now, I didn't know Nikki was an alcoholic until about 6 months after we were together. I didn't even know he had moved in with me. Until he brought his hairspray and his hair dryer to the house. And then I knew it's got to be serious, right? So we had such a good time. You know, Nikki had a job when we met, and but not for long. I traveled in my job then. I had different places, mostly in California, great places to go to, and the company was so great, you know, they paid for fine hotels, and I had an expense account and everything. I had to report a lot of those things on my fourth step later on, but I actually, in my heart of hearts, in that secret nasty place, I was glad that he wasn't working after a while, because he could go with me. He could go with me to places like Santa Barbara, San Diego, San Francisco, Palm Springs, those kinds of places. And I would go to these places and I would have to report to the office, wherever the town was. I'd have to go to the office and do my work. And maybe it would be a 3-day thing or 4-day. And the only thing Nikki had to do was get room service for himself at this fine hotel and decide where we were going to have dinner that night and where we were going to go dancing. That was his job. So he was just, you know, bought and paid for practically. And it did not.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Faze me, because that denial was very, very strong. It was like big, nasty drapes, filthy, but I was in this side of them until I went into Al-Anon, until I came to the program. And then that denial had to start sweeping away, carving away. And that went on. And the only time I would get angry at him was at the end of the month, or, you know, when the statement came for the credit card, then I would see all the, because he was a big tipper. But it was my money. It was my card. And he had been in the food business before he lost everything. He was a real alcoholic. I didn't even know it. Oh, I know. I thought he was real healthy because he had, he always carried a bottle of grapefruit juice. This much grapefruit juice, just to give it a little yellow tinge, and the rest was vodka. I didn't know that for a long time. Gee. And so then when I would get angry at him, mad at him, get out, I'd throw his clothes. I'd try to throw him, but he was too big. Get out, get out. And then he would say, wait a minute, honey, wait. I've got a banquet. I'm going to work at a banquet. And that would satisfy me. He was going to do a banquet. But that's only one day. And on this one particular day, he worked the banquet, but it was like some kind of a shower. Anyway, he was drinking the champagne in the back and then serving the champagne in the front at the banquet. And he did that a lot that day, and he got drunk. He got very drunk, and he fell. And when he fell, he cut his leg. And when he cut his leg, they couldn't stop the bleeding. So he had to go, they sent for an ambulance, and they sent him to the Whittier Hospital. At the Whittier Hospital, he found out, they told him that he had cirrhosis of the liver. His liver was messed up. And if he drank again, he would die. And so he got scared. And he was so charming and such a charismatic guy that for some reason, the doctors at the hospital called around to see where they could send him to get sober. And there was one bed at this one place in El Monte. It was a 6-month place. And they called over there and they said, there's one bed, do you want it? And he said, yes. So he did. He went to El Monte. And during that 6 months, he got sober. They fed him AA 24 hours a day. And at some point, the loved ones could come as part of the family. He didn't have any family here, although he'd been married 5 times. But that was all in the other parts of the United States. And so he wanted to go, and when they let the loved ones start coming for these sessions, that's when I was able to go to this place. And then eventually we could go to open AA meetings outside of the facility. And that's what I did. I took him to meetings, open meetings outside. And that's when I learned to love AA. You know, these people that got up to share in the AA meetings, they were my mother. They were my uncle. They were my other grandmother. I got to hear the stories, and I felt what I know now was compassion for the alcoholic, or my son. And it was just wonderful. And that's where my Al-Anon program came alive. And that was because an old-timer at one of these AA meetings said, it's nice that you come and come over here and you bring Nikki, but you should probably go to Al-Anon. And I said, oh, I've been to Al-Anon. I go once in a while to that Whittier meeting. And he said, didn't they give you a directory? He said, there's so many meetings in LA, so many meetings. Why don't you try some? And so I did. I got the directory, I opened the directory, and I started going to meetings everywhere, including Orange County, Pasadena, all over. I got on fire simply because I had been going to those AA meetings. And somebody suggested. And I just got into it. I got so into my program. And yeah, I may have gone overboard. I have a disease of extremes, so it's either all of this or all of that. And I just went for it. I wanted service, I wanted this, I wanted that. I bought all the books, but I didn't get a sponsor. I was looking for a sponsor, somebody just like me. And thank God that I didn't find that person. So time goes on, and Nikki, he gets sober. He's fantastic, and he starts sponsoring people and all that, and loving it. And they loved him, and he was sober for 2.5 years. 2.5 years, which was like a lifetime for him. He had never been sober before. And so we were together off and on about 10 years. After he thought he could drink like a gentleman, and he couldn't, and he just went way out, and his health went down and down. I couldn't deal with that anymore, and I knew that I wasn't God, and I wasn't his savior, and I couldn't help him, and I was not in the rescue business. Thank you very much. So I got out of that relationship, but he would still call, you know. He would still call every once in a while, and but I knew that I couldn't deal. And so, but he kept my phone number in his wallet. And I got the phone call one day from the hospital that Nikki was in the hospital and it was bad. And they found my phone number in his wallet. And was I someone that could possibly come and see him? Well, I called the man that had been his sponsor, and a lot of AA people, plus people from Al-Anon that knew him, and we went to the hospital, and he lasted 11 days. Mm-hmm. And in that time, he was just so sick. The gorgeous, gorgeous man was no longer gorgeous. It was just, the disease is a killer, and it took everything from him. That and it was such a sad thing. People that knew him still talk about him, still remember the crazy guy that he was, and how much he loved AA. And so in the meantime, my son meets a very nice girl, a librarian. Not that all librarians are nice, but he meets a librarian, and they got married, and they had a little apartment in Pasadena, and without any interference from me, any help from so-called help from me, they started having a life, and that. He would call me on Sundays when my daughter-in-law went to church. That's when my son would call me, and oh, we'd have these great conversations. We'd laugh. He was just so sweet, I just loved talking to him. And about once a month, they would ask me to come for lunch. And whereas before, when I used to hug my son, I would smell him to see if he was high or what was happening there. I didn't do that anymore. On the way from my place, by this time I'm living in Orange County, to Pasadena, I would pray, I would pray that my God would go in there with me and that I would just be his loving mother, which I was. And so we did that, and I loved him. And by this time, Nikki was gone, and now I'm in a solid program. I'm doing service, I'm doing panels and whatever, and I'm happy, but I don't have a significant other, and I don't really miss it. But I decided to write a letter to God, and I said, you know, basically, if you want me to have a romantic relationship, please, it's up to you, and you have to put him right in front of me because I don't know how to pick him. And I dated it because I date everything. I used to work for lawyers. Everything is always dated. I folded it, and I put it in my God box, and I forgot about it. Because once it's in the God box, it becomes God's business, is what I was told. So then, 6 months later, I met the man who God sent me. And for once in my life, I didn't put this guy on a pedestal. I didn't think that, you know, he was the beginning and the end of everything. For once in my life, and because of the kind of man he is, I was myself. By this time, the program is sort of working, and I feel like I don't have to be a chameleon. I don't have to change myself to what I think you want me to be. And so, and it felt good, and it felt loving, and it was nurturing. Everything that I wanted from my mother, from my father, from, you know, was coming because I first went to that higher power. It works. It works so, so good. And so so we got together, and it was an amazing thing. So now we're living in Orange County. We're together, and I'm doing. He meets all my family, my children, and he didn't get to meet my mother. She had passed on, and I get a call one morning, early in the morning, from my daughter-in-law, and she said, you know. She's crying. She said, Mark's very sick. That's my son. He's hallucinating. What shall I do? I said, call 911 and call me right back. Tell me what hospital he's in. And that was God saying, giving me the intuitive thought of what to say. She called me back and she said, he's at St. Luke's in Pasadena, and I said, we're on our way. And my husband, who wasn't even my husband yet, but we were living together, got to drive to Pasadena, and while he's driving, I'm calling Al-Anon people and relatives and people that live closer to Pasadena. When we get to Pasadena, to the hospital, there's a lot of people there already waiting for us. And I got to go in to see him. I have to tell you that I called a sponsor before I left for the hospital. And the sponsor said, remember, what you're going to see is only his vehicle. It's not him. It's not him. So it's just his vehicle. And it's a good thing I heard that and put it in my heart, because what I saw was just not my son. Not my son. And but he was so scared. He opened his eyes so big. When I got to touch him, there were doctors and nurses. And the doctors took me aside and they said, we're going to do everything we can for him. And so I said, okay. So so now it was the process of being at the hospital all the time. We went and we rented a motel close to the hospital. And went and got clothes, and so we could change every day and go in the hospital and everything. And do you know, they started giving him blood transfusions and everything that they did for him, because everything had been shutting down, the kidneys, everything had been shutting down, his liver. And so he got color in his face, and his lips were not cracking and dry anymore. And oh my God, he was eating well, and he was doing so, so good. And my daughter-in-law is not in our program. I believe that there's a chair here for her, but she's not in it. But she's a church girl, and so her church people were there with her, and so many miracles and blessings happened at that hospital. Out of the seemingly bad, there's always something good. I made amends to my ex-husband at that hospital during that time. And the way that happened is not my way, it was God's way. I had gone to the restroom, and it was a crowded hospital, and there was a lot of us there on the way back from the restroom back into the common area where all the people were. Who's walking down in this nobody else hall except my ex-husband? And I'm just getting out of the bathroom. No place to run, no place to hide. And I hadn't seen him. I hadn't seen him in all that time. And so here he comes and here I come. And when I got to right where he was, I went like this, and that was not me. That was not me. And so, you know, I made amends to him. He wasn't sure what I was going to do. He went like this. But it was an amends. And so then about 10 days passed, 11 days actually, and we had to go back home and get some more clothes to come back. And we did. We went home. And when we were home, the phone rang. And it was the nurse at the hospital. And she says, you got to get back here. There's been a change. And so one more time, my husband's driving to Pasadena. And he wasn't even my husband yet. He's doing that without a word. Saying, do we have to go back again like the alcoholic would have done or something? And I'm calling friends and family. And when we got to the hospital and we got to where the nurses are, the nurse was standing in front of his room and she shook her head. Because I went like this and she shook her head. And his curtains of his window were closed. And when we got, I ran into the room, and my daughter-in-law and two ladies were sitting in up against the wall, and they had already taken all the tubes and everything that was gone. And my son had clean sheets. And they had lowered the lights, and he was gone. He was gone. And I just knew that was just his vehicle, that he had gone home, and that somebody in our program told me later, because it was October 2nd, and she said, why don't you think of October 2nd as his sobriety date. And that made sense to me. That's his sobriety date. He doesn't have to fight it anymore. Yes, he doesn't have to drink anymore. He's just free. Free. And that's when we celebrate his experience, because I get to share it. Part of my service that I do, that I love, I do panels. I used to go in with Gary to juvenile hall. And Gary's still going into juvenile hall. Now that I'm living over in the Inland Empire, we got a panel and we go into a rehab place, and and we give the Al-Anon part, the Al-Anon side of things, even though these lovely people are suffering from their diseases. But I think that I absolutely have a purpose, and I give credit to all the drinkers, all of the people that have been in my life. I give them credit for that. Today, the year after my son died, Mike asked me to marry him, and we've been together for, it'll be 13 years now. And it's a good thing. It's a good thing. It's a God thing. How much time do I have, Ann?
Five?
Okay. So, one of the things about serenity, I know that's our theme, is that, as I said, I didn't have it until Al-Anon. But I was not a work in progress until I did the work. And so I'm doing the work, and it's just, I get so much more. I get so much back, way more. I'm overpaid. I've heard that said in these rooms. I'm overpaid in the program. I have nothing but gratitude in my heart today. The God of my understanding is just so powerful and always there, never has a busy signal, doesn't have a message machine. I have a direct line to that God. Things are happening. Things happen in my life that are only God stories. Last year, a friend that I had known for over 40 years, that had helped my family so much. I worked for him for many years, and he had just done so much for. He's a lawyer, so he did so many things to help my family out of problems and so forth. He asked me for a favor last year, and to sign some papers that it was not going to be anything financial on my part. See, I still have financial fears, so that's always a question in my mind. Is it going to cost me anything? No. Oh, no. And it turned out that I was his victim of identity theft. He took my name and forged it on check after check after check to the tune of thousands of dollars. And it broke my heart. it broke my heart. And at first, I just wanted, my first thing is, if I'm betrayed, I want revenge. You know, that's where my head goes. I want revenge. And a sponsor said, no, just do the next indicated thing. What would you do if it wasn't someone that you considered a friend? Oh, I'd go to the police. I'd make a police report. Well, then that's what you do. And that's what I did. That's exactly what I did. And I tried talking to the person one time. Oh, and there was one woman at the bank. I started getting these calls that I owed all this money and that my name was on there, so it was my responsibility. And there was one woman at the bank that believed my story, that I had been hoodwinked into signing this. So I went and I got in touch with the police. Cop came over to my house and filled out all the papers. And that was the next indicated thing. And then somebody, this woman at the bank, the same woman, said, you probably need a lawyer. So I got a lawyer. I used to work for lawyers, so, you know, through that grapevine, I got a very good lawyer. And he thought it was a good case. And so all that process, what I've learned in Al-Anon that gives me serenity is to believe in the process. Everything is a process. Getting ready to come here today was that too. Process. See, one of my things that I don't have very much of is patience and tolerance. So this is teaching me. Everything is a lesson for me. So everything was just let go, let God, let go, let God, a day at a time, a day at a time. And yesterday, I got the detective's report. Yesterday, a day before I'm coming here, I got the detective's report that said, in my opinion, and mentioned that person's name, is responsible for blah, 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 blah. And so Lydia Valverde has no, there's no reason to bother her. So that's where that stands, and that's all because of this program, because of God, because of all of the things. So the last thing I'm going to say is good things don't happen to us because we're good, and bad things don't happen to us because we're bad. Things happen because it's life. Thanks for letting me share.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.